Okay, so as everyone knows, we've been on a series of discussions on metta, loving kindness, as part of the Eightfold Noble Path. And metta, of course, a loving kindness, is part of right thought, which is the second of the Eightfold Noble Path factors. And right thought is comprised of three sort of major components. The first is renunciation, and that is the idea of living a balanced life between desire and hatred, you know, greed, hatred, and delusion. So a life that's not spent in greed or clinging or desire or hatred or aversion, so a balanced life. Renunciation means renouncing our tendency to become addicted to our desires and cravings or our aversions and our hatreds. So renunciation is living that life of moderation, you know, between our desires and our aversions. The second one is metta, living a life of metta. And the third is living a life of karuna or compassion. So these three forms of right thought represent not absolute states of being, but rather as aspirations, rather as intentions that we bring to our life in our spiritual path. And I think the wisdom of the Buddha was in his understanding that no one is perfect, we're all imperfect, we're all still living in Darwin's world of natural selection. So it takes training, it takes conscious effort to cultivate these qualities of moderation and balance, loving kindness and compassion. But these are the three aspects of spiritual attainment. This is what a spiritually realized being comes to perfect in one's life: a life of moderation and balance, a life of loving kindness, and a life of compassion. These are the three hallmarks of a spiritually evolved person. So we've been talking about metta, or loving kindness, and last week we spoke about the near enemy of metta, which is desire. So, for example, in relationships, particularly in relationships, relationships tend to be determined by desire, you know, physical attraction between a man and a woman, or even between a man and a man, and a woman and a woman. You know, any kind of physical relationship between two people tends to be affected by or initiated by a sense of physical attraction, right? We're physically attracted to a person, and that we are attracted to people who fill our needs, right? Who give us what we want, who somehow fulfill an aspiration or a desire that we have. You know, a person whose personality complements our personality, or who makes us laugh or makes me feel good, or, you know, is complimentary to me, or whatever, you know, whatever that reason we may have for having a relationship with a person, it's basically how that person fulfills what we want, fulfills our expectations. Virtually all our relationships are built on expectations of something we want. So this is the nature of things. So this is what the foundation of what desire is. So if that relationship is threatened, we get angry, we feel threatened, we feel anxious, stressed out. So we're in the hold of desire. So where do we bring true, unconditional loving kindness into this equation? See, this is the question. How many of our relationships are actually portionally predominated by this sense of unconditional love that's not based on any kind of expectation or desire? Now, most frequently, the example that's used is the love of a mother for her only child. Now, that's a little bit different. The nature of that relationship is different, right? Because a mother doesn't choose the child comes. And a child doesn't choose the mother, you know, that child comes into the world. So it's not a matter of choice. So we're not making any any decision based on any kind of expectation, but it's a natural process where we're gifted with a relationship that literally comes out of our own body. I mean, I'm speaking as a woman, literally comes out of our own body. So there's a basis for unconditionality there, right? In terms of what Jesus might have said, love thy neighbor as thou would love thyself. Someone who comes from your own body is of yourself. So as you would love yourself, you would love this person, this child that comes from you. So that is a bond. That's the kind of bond. But can you love another person with the same sense of unconditionality that a mother would love a child who emanated from her own body? So this is the challenge. And so the reason why I say it this way is that to emphasize this whole notion of metta or loving kindness as an aspiration, not as an absolute thing that we need to embody. It's an aspiration. It's something that we bring into our lives. And we bring into our lives with a sense of consciousness of purpose. You know, and so it's also a practice, right? It's a practice. It's something that we have to do consciously to cultivate in our lives. So in the same way that we spoke about cultivating communication with people of different values, political values, this extends to everything in our life in terms of our cultivating our relationships of this metta with everyone in our lives. People who are close to us, people who are neutral people, difficult people. It doesn't matter, you know, so this whole discussion of political difference is only a minor subset of other people in our lives for whom we need to develop this ability to cultivate this sense of metta, of loving kindness and compassion. So as we do this practice, you know, it's really, really important to understand that when we do, for example, as we do the meditation, the metta meditation, just because we say the phrases, you know, may you be well, happy, and peaceful, or may you be free of suffering, just because we say these things, it doesn't mean that metta will automatically, you know, manifest as if we're going to become this paragon of loving kindness and compassion. These are ways of working toward that feeling, that way of seeing people in the world. So as we do the practice, as we do the metta meditations, it's a really good practice both in the formal meditation and in our daily life to try to cultivate a feeling of loving kindness. And when the feeling of metta arises and is strong and it's clear, to actually stop for a moment when you feel this feeling coming on or you have a sense of compassion or loving kindness, to stop and look at the feeling itself. Say to yourself, what does this feel like? Literally, what does this feel like? Try to frame that feeling just for a moment in your mind. Really take a look at it. Understand that this is what the feeling of loving kindness is like. You know, we never really do that, right? When you're kind to a person, when you do something, a gesture of kindness or compassion, have you ever stopped to consider what it feels like when you actually do that? It's probably a feeling, it's a fleeting thing that happens probably in a nanosecond. It comes and it goes. And of course, you know, you might have a pleasant response. A person might feel grateful and thank you for your kindness or something like that. So it feels good in that moment. But within yourself, you know, what does it actually feel like? So this is how we begin to cultivate it. We begin to know what it feels like. Really know what it feels like. We understand its unique qualities, because the more easily we recognize it, then we can more easily cultivate it and access it. So as we develop and cultivate this feeling, it becomes more the way we are than simply something we do. It's more the way we are. It's not just a simple bunch of phrases that we recite at the end of a meditation. Now, there are ways of doing this. So what I'm talking about is how we can consciously cultivate a kind of practice in our daily life, not just metta meditation, but actually in our daily life. So, for example, if you are walking down the street, or if you're in a store, or if you're in a restaurant where you're among people who you don't know, generally when you're in a grocery store, or you don't feel connected to the people around you, right? You're so focused on what you're interested in buying or your transaction with the cashier, you kind of have a sense of tunnel vision. And if anybody talks to you or asks you a question, you feel a little nervous and offended, like this person is trying to hit on you or something, you know. So we feel defended from the people around us. And normally that's, I think, how we generally operate. But have you ever considered, when you're in a store, or when you're in a grocery store or a store or in a restaurant, to begin to sort of look at the people around you with a sense of metta, loving kindness? It's so simple. Like, even when you're walking down the street, can you just simply start doing metta for everybody in the street or in the store? You know, it doesn't mean you have to, you know, stand up and hug everybody, but just kind of feel the sense of the opening of your heart to the people around you, a kind of friendliness. And don't be afraid to say hello. You know, don't be afraid to say thank you. Oh, that's such a beautiful dress you're wearing, or a nice hairdo, or say something to express kindness, openness to the people around you. I know that's not easy. We kind of have to cultivate it, because we're afraid that if we say hello, we're going to get shut down, right? The person's going to insult us or turn away and ignore us. But even if a person does that, it's okay, in the sense that not everybody's going to respond, but it's not about the response. See, that's the whole point we were talking about before, right? It's not about the response. It's not about what you get back, but it's about what you put out. So if you're putting out with the expectation of getting something back, then that's the wrong way of doing it. It's putting out for the sake of putting out, just to be friendly, to show metta, to show loving kindness, without any expectation of a friendly response. And say to yourself, may everyone here be happy. May everyone here be at peace. May everyone be free of suffering. Just kind of say it to yourself. Just say it to everyone in the room or in the store, wherever you are. Believe me, it'll make a difference. It's amazing the change that happens, even in a moment. If nothing else, even in your own heart, instead of being disconnected, all of a sudden you feel a sense of connectedness to the people around you. And your mind and your heart feels like it's expanding and becoming more inclusive. It's as if we gather everyone up in a field of goodwill, a field of metta, loving kindness. I've been trying to do this myself. Actually, this is something that's very conscious with me. I do try to do this. When I'm in a restaurant or a store, I try to reach out and be friendly and say nice things. Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And I often say, excuse me, what is your name, sir? You know, or what is your name, ma'am? You know, and they would tell me their name, and I would say, oh, thank you so much. You know, I really appreciate what you're saying or what you're doing in your service. Whenever I'm on a telephone call, you know, like I'm ordering something, or like I'm making a purchase, talking to someone on the phone, I would always ask their name and say, excuse me, ma'am, what is your name? And they would tell me her name. I just want to thank you for your service, and I really appreciate what you're doing. And it's funny, you know, the response you get. Sometimes people, they don't know how to respond to that, because nobody ever thanks them for what they do, you know. But it's that kind of showing that kind of gratitude. I remember one time, actually this just happened the other day. I was driving down the street, and I know every one of you have seen this. You drive down the street, you come to an intersection, and there's this homeless guy sitting there with a big sign. And everybody's sitting there, and their windows are all closed, and they're not paying attention to this guy who's standing out there with this sign that says, I am homeless, please help me. And so there I was, sitting in this intersection, and I saw this fellow sitting. I mean, he was literally about 3 feet away from me, you know, outside my car window. So I rolled down the window. I fumbled in my wallet, put out a dollar, rolled down my window. I looked at the fellow, and I reached out and handed him a dollar. And I was doing this very consciously, literally the way I'm saying it. So I'm observing myself as I do this to see what I feel literally in my heart as I hand him the money, and he looks at me and he realizes that I'm handing him some money. And in this case, it was a good reaction. He said, oh, God bless you, God bless you. And I said, oh, you're welcome, you were no problem, you know, good luck, you know. And we exchanged a few words, and then the traffic started moving. But there was this moment, there was this little burst in my heart, this little flash. It just felt really good. It really felt good. Fortunately, I got a good response, you know, so it went well. I mean, there are times when it doesn't go well. The person just takes the money, turns around, and walks away, right? But that's okay. You just did what you had to do. So this is a conscious thing. You have to say, I'm going to do this. You've all seen homeless people on the street. You've all had opportunities to reach out to someone in an act of kindness. Of course, if you're a female, you know, you have to be careful, you know, that for the security, you know, you don't want to put yourself at unnecessary risk. But if it's safe to just extend yourself out in an act of kindness, and as you do it very consciously, like as a meditation, like you're observing yourself as you do it. What you're doing is you're mindfully cultivating this practice of metta, of compassion. So you're doing it consciously and you're aware of the way it feels in your body so that the next time you do it, you know that feeling. So you're becoming more familiar with what it feels like to actually practice metta, loving kindness. So this is a practice. It really is a practice. And it goes against our natural tendency to, you know, to separate out, to isolate off, to feel defended against people around us because of our own security. You know, and that's a natural thing. We want to feel secure. So it requires us, it calls on us to go beyond our natural tendency to isolate and defend, but reach out in loving kindness and compassion. Now, sometimes it's easier in this practice to connect with kindness, the kindness aspect, than with the love aspect. Because in English, love is a big word, right? I mean, it means a lot of things. And it's very subtle and it's very complex in its meaning, you know, the word love. And our understanding of love has very often been so powerfully conditioned by forces in our society. You know, there's a sense of desire, sexual attraction, physical attraction. So love is a big, big word. And it's also conditioned by our movies, novels, and, you know, everything. You know, the word love is so huge, you know, in our culture. So in the light of this, people can often feel that they're not loving enough, or that somehow they don't have the capacity for this kind of love. We feel inadequate. Maybe we should feel we should have some great ecstatic feeling that sweeps us away in waves of bliss and rapture when we get into these, you know, hyper fields of love and compassion and loving kindness. It's not like that at all. It really isn't. It's really a kind of misguided notion, you know, of what loving kindness is. But looking at it in another way, kindness, the word kindness, is much more pragmatic. It's much more humble. It's much more doable. It's more down to earth, very pragmatic. It's just being kind. Just being kind. It's just a friendly and spontaneous responsiveness to people and situations around us with kindness. Okay, so we don't have to love everybody, but we can be kind. Kindness. It's so important. We can be kind, and it's not a complicated thing. Kindness is a basic and natural openness of heart that lets the world in. So think of it as kindness practice, a very conscious, deliberate kindness practice. Now, there's an article in the New York Times about a study that shows that even babies, toddlers, under 2 years old, have this natural responsiveness of kindness. So this is almost a kind of a, you know, hardwired in ways that we don't probably understand. It's a natural quality of kindness. So this is from the article. This scientist is doing these activities in front of these babies, and it goes like this. Oops, the scientist dropped his clothespin. So he was working with clothespins. But not to worry, a wobbly toddler races to help, eagerly handing it back. The simple experiment shows that the capacity for altruism emerges as early as 19 months of age in babies. Psychology research, Felix Warnken was his name, performed a series of ordinary tasks in front of toddlers, such as hanging towels with clothespins or stacking books, you know, in a pile. Sometimes he appeared to struggle with the task. Sometimes he deliberately messed up. Over and over, whether Warnikin dropped clothespins or knocked over his books, each of the 24 toddlers offered help within seconds, but only if he appeared to actually need it. This is amazing. Only if he appeared to actually need it. The video, and there was this video, shows how one baby glanced between Warnikin's face and the dropped clothespin before quickly crawling over, grabbing the object, pushing it up to his feet, and eagerly handing the pin back to Warnikin. Warnikin never asked for the help and didn't even say thank you. He didn't even acknowledge it, so as to not taint the research by training youngsters to expect praise if they helped. So this was clearly not about indoctrinating kids to expect praise. It's just to see their natural response to the situation. So after all, altruism means helping with no expectation of anything in return, right? This is what kindness, loving kindness is. And this is the key that toddlers didn't bother to offer help when he deliberately pulled the book off the stack or threw a pin onto the floor. If it looked like a conscious action, they didn't do anything. But if it looked like a mistake, then they would respond. It's amazing to see this natural responsiveness to help, this natural response of kindness. So this is something that's within us, even as children. It's a natural response. Of course, as we get older, we learn to mute that response, right? Because of safety, security, or whatever, right? We're not going to get anything for what we do, so our mind kicks in. You know, it's like, the reward principle kicks in, and we don't respond to what is, in fact, a natural response, you know, to the situation. So the question is, how do we reconnect with the spontaneous kindness of that toddler? It's there. So how do we reconnect? How do we reconnect with that in ourselves? So it is there. It is there. It's just, how can we bring it out again in our lives? Now, one of the immediate causes for loving kindness is the practice of focusing on the good qualities that people have, the good qualities in ourselves. We are all a package of qualities. We're never the same all the time. We're a different package of qualities. Some are desirable, some are not so desirable. When we don't see the good in people and focus instead on their annoying, irritating qualities, it's easy for ill will and judgment, anger, and sometimes even hatred to arise. It's easy. But if we can make it a practice, and it takes practice, I mean, again, this is a practice, you know, to see people and relate to the good in the people, the good in each person, then the feeling of loving kindness arises more spontaneously if we start to see the good in people. All of these practices, reaching out to a homeless person or giving or contributing or donating or showing loving kindness in a crowded situation with people, or unsolicited acts of kindness, or seeing the good in people, in our relationships and the people around us, these are conscious acts. They're not spontaneous. I think we're mistaken if we think that we beat on ourselves for not being able to spontaneously respond with generosity or loving kindness. It's a practice. It's an aspiration. Now, all of these efforts at first might require some effort, a change of mental habit, because we've so often habituated ourselves to focus on what's negative, to focus on ourselves, on our own welfare, or to pick out what's wrong with the situation. So we need to change the habit of our mind, and it's the recognition that we all have a kind of inner remote. You know, it's like a TV remote. We can change the channel. We can see that the mind is often on the channel of aversion, seeing what's difficult in people. And if we see that, And if we're mindful of it, we can change the channel. I mean, think of yourself, the way you think about people as a habit. You know, it's like we reinforce the way we see people by seeing them in certain ways, in terms of, do they meet our expectations? Do they not meet our expectations? Do I like it? Do I don't like it? You know, all of these responses to people are habits that are based on our conditioning. They're based on our expectation, which is based on our conditioning. So those are our habits. Those are the channels through which we view the world and view our relationships. So if we can see it that way, you know, it's like the neurology of thought is such that by having a particular thought, the synaptic pathways in our brain, you know, certain linkages happen in our synaptic pathways, right? The neurons are firing. And then when that thought is repeated, that synaptic path gets reinforced. And as it's repeated again and again and again and again, what was just a foot trail becomes a superhighway. This is how thinking patterns get reinforced in the brain and they become habits. Those habits are what we call channels, right? That's, you know, we respond to our situation according to how we habitually have been conditioned to respond to situations. So it's learning how to change those channels, realizing that how we respond is part of a pattern. And this is where we bring mindfulness wisdom to our behavior. If we tend to respond with aversion, with judgment, with criticism, it's learning to look at that within ourselves and seeing that that is how we tend to look at our situations, and then consciously trying to change it, consciously trying to see the good in people, or seeing things from a different perspective rather than the way we normally, you know, tend to see things. We can change the channel. We just direct our attention, even if at first it takes some effort, just change the direction of our attention. Opening up, become softer to the situation. Don't harden, but open, become softer. Can we see the good in that person? And sometimes it's as basic as just recognizing that we're all human beings. You know, we all have our moments. You know, we all have our hissy fits or whatever, you know, and learn to forgive and not to judge. So we're all suffering in one way or another. Like seeing the suffering and knowing that you yourself suffered in the same way. It's that connection that you make that allows you to open your heart in loving kindness because you see your common humanness. This is so, so important. It's just about recognizing the commonality of us all. And as we develop this habit of seeing the good in people, even as we recognize the complexity, you know, of the whole person, and this goes right back to this whole thing about political values and communication, even though we see the complexity, differences in our views, we can see the whole person. We can see their basic humanity. We can really begin to respond in a much more generous, you know, and loving way. So these are practices. These are ways in which we can consciously connect, you know, to those around us, particularly those for whom we would not be able to connect with, you know, basically in terms of differences of values, differences of opinions, differences of views, difficult people in our lives, or just people in general, opening our hearts in ways that allow us to connect. I have a funny story that I'd like to share. This actually happened quite a long time ago, I think when I was in my 30s or 40s. But I was driving across the country, and literally I was driving across the country from Washington, D.C. to San Francisco, and I was in a little Toyota, you know, a little Toyota Corolla. This was in the 80s, I think. I think it was in the 80s. And we were driving through some western state, I think it was Nevada or Colorado, going through these circuitous mountain, you know, roads way up in the middle of nowhere. And we were driving along, and there was a car that was stopped along the side of the road at one of these outlooks. And this person was, it looked like he was in some kind of trouble. It was a man, I was driving with my wife at the time, and the two of us in this little brown Toyota Corolla. And I saw this fellow, and I just drove right up to him. I said, "Do you need any help?" You know, and he kind of looked at me, and he said, "Yeah, okay." So I jumped out, and I think he was changing his tire. This happened a long time ago. He was changing his tires. And so I helped him change his tire, and I was getting right in my car and said, are you from Hawaii?" I said, "Well, actually, I am." He said, "Yeah, well, you know, for some reason, you know, you really have some kind of aloha spirit or something. You know, like, I really appreciate that." And he just said that out of the clear blue. And I was really touched. I said, "Yeah, actually, I am from Hawaii. I'm driving back to Hawaii now. It's coming from, you know." So we started to talk, and we had a really friendly conversation. But the fact that he said that. And let me share another story, actually. As I'm saying this another story came up. This was in 1967. I graduated from college, and I was on the East Coast attending graduate school in New Haven, Connecticut. And so the first weekend I was there, I wanted to go down to New York because I'm a jazz buff. You know, I love jazz. And I was into John Coltrane, and I wanted to see John Coltrane and his group. Actually, he had just passed away a month previous to that, but his group with Pharoah Sanders and Rashid Ali was performing at a club called Slugs on the Lower East Side, way, 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 way down on the far Lower East Side. And I didn't even, it was the first time I even been to New York, right? So I get to the city, and I literally from Grand Central Station, I call this club. I said, "Can you tell me where you are?" So he says, "Okay, well, you get on the train, you go down this far, and then you walk 10 blocks east," right? Said, "Okay," right? So I got on the train, went down, and I started walking down to the Lower East Side. And that was the summer when they were having all the riots in New York City and New Jersey, and the cities were on fire. And I'm walking down the street, and literally there's a car turned over in the middle of the street on its roof on fire, literally on fire. And there's no fire truck around. The buildings are all abandoned, the windows are all shattered, the doors are all closed down. And there was a guy sitting on a stoop. It looks like he had just been beaten up, literally beaten up. He looked like a homeless guy. There was a beard and stubble. There was blood all over his face. His clothes were all torn up, and he was sitting there crying on the stoop. And here's this kid, right, from Hawaii, you know, kind of walking down the street, and I saw this guy. I was by myself, and I didn't know how to react. Naturally, I was really nervous because, you know, this car was on fire, and we can hear sirens going off in the distance. But I just kind of walked up to this guy, and I said, "Hey, man, you need any help? You need any help?" Looking at him, you know, and he looked at me, and he just said, "No, no, no, get out of here, you know. Get out of here," you know. And I said, "Well, okay, you know." So I just kind of backed off. And then as I was walking down, he said, hey, you know, and I turned around and he said, "Hey, thanks, man, thanks." And that was it. I just walked away. I still remember that from 1967. Of course, I was a pretty naive young man at that time. I didn't know. I could have, you know, who knows what could have happened to me. But the point is, it's those moments of just reaching out. So this is a practice. If we determine in our hearts that, okay, I'm going to do this. I'm going to give a donation to that homeless person, or I'm going to be kind to this person. Make a conscious decision and do it. And then watch yourself as you do it. Literally, watch yourself as you do it. This is the practice. Then as you do it, as you cultivate it, gradually it takes hold in your heart. And you tend to soften. You tend to soften. Believe me, you do tend to soften. Often to the point where you become a softy, right? But you don't want to become too much of a softy, of course. You know, you have to know the bounds of what is, you know, you don't want to become a doormat, but at the same time, there's a moral, ethical firmness about yourself, but at the same time, you have this capacity for love. So it is a practice, and it is a way of cultivating this in your life. And if you do it, believe me, you do change. You do change. You feel less defended, less insecure, less needing to defend yourself against circumstances and people, more open, more accepting, and kinder. So, as the Buddha said, it's an aspiration. It's an intention that we bring into our lives. It's not an absolute thing. So if we know that, we can understand that this is a journey, this is a process, and it's a practice. So if we bring this practice into our life in a very conscious way, we can cultivate it and become more loving, more kind, and more compassionate in our lives. Okay, thank you. Thank you all so much. It was really a pleasure to be able to share this. And actually, there's more to it. And so we'll continue this discussion next week on metta, loving kindness.